Now, all those fire ratings are determined by these guys. Remember, these are the guys that build it, burn it, break it, best job ever. And those, that directory of assemblies, that's in the Art and Architecture Library, and pretty much every office that you work with will probably have that. I think they'll let you subscribe to it online now. But they do tests, so if the steel company sends them steel beams and the drywall companies are trying to say, we'd like to sell a lot of drywall to protect steel, they'll say, all right, pay us the money, we'll build a column assembly, we'll put it in our oven, we'll start the fire, we'll cook it up to temperature, we'll hold it at temperature for as many hours as it'll stand, then we'll hit it with a fire hose and see if it explodes, then we'll write you the results. So in this case, they got two columns that they're testing. So the drywall companies are trying to get two pre-engineered solutions because they know that if they figure it out for you, you're more likely to use it than if you have to do all the testing yourself, because it's about probably about $500,000 a test. Not too many owners are going to foot that bill. Yeah. Those ovens are expensive. So here we got two column assemblies. You see both of them get a two-hour rating, but one of them's got two layers of 5/8 inch fire code sheetrock, not half inch like we use in residential, 5/8. We got two layers there. We got two layers on the flanges, two layers protecting the web. And this one only has one layer, but it's the same sheetrock. So what? How does that work? Say it. Thicker steel. So there's this steel has more mass in it, which means it can soak up more heat and distribute that heat before it gets critical temperature. And what happens when steel gets critical? Loses strength, right? So the secret to this one working, look at the weight of that piece of steel. How much does that steel weigh a foot? The W14 by 228, so how much does that thing weigh per linear foot? Wild guess. 228, exactly. 228 pounds a foot. That's quite a piece of steel. Now, so mass is one strategy, but typically what we're trying to do is just keep the heat away from the steel. So you can either insulate it or keep the fire away from it, or you can suppress the fire. Insulate, we usually do some combination of these strategies in buildings. So insulate, we could cover the steel with concrete. And that gets really hard, right? Put up all the steel, then try to build formwork around the steel and pour it full. That's really tough. Now the columns we got at Bishop Favreau, they're hollow steel tubes, right? HSS sections. Not so hard to pour concrete into the top of those, is it? Because the steel is the formwork. And all they would tell you is, if you're going to do that, why would they count that as a way of protecting that steel column? Well, if you reinforce it and the steel fails, you still have a column. What's the other advantage of just pouring concrete into those steel tubes? Keeps the inside from heating up because the concrete adds more mass. Exactly. And all they would tell us is, make sure you put holes in the steel somewhere so that the steam that's going to cook off of the concrete doesn't blow the column apart. So you'll see that in some places. People will say, take the steel hollow tube and fill it with concrete. Now, if you've got a truss made out of that, that's almost impossible, right? You better do that concrete filling on the ground. You'll never be able to do it in place. So that one's not used so often. Gypsum board is really common. That's Kent Square. So we just build sheetrock boxes around everything. And the sheetrock basically operates like concrete. So it contains water in its molecular structure. And as you heat it up, it takes the heat from the fire and converts the water inside it to steam. So you're using up the heat in the fire to make that conversion. That way the heat can't get at your steel. You got to throw the sheetrock away afterwards. It's true. But if the steel survives, it's a deal. Spray-on mineral fiber. This is the stuff that comes out of it's byproducts from our coal-burning power plants. Also, mined minerals like perlite, and they shred it and turn it into fibers, and they mix it with water and spray it on the steel, and it's like insulation. It's like putting on a wool jacket. So you can spray on that stuff. And the last one, the most expensive one, is magic paint. So this paint goes on. It's almost more like mastic than it is paint. It is thick and it's kind of hard to handle, and you put it on and you're trying to get a coating that, instead of measuring, like paint you usually measure in mil thickness, this magic paint you measure in decimals of an inch. It's that thick. So it's hard to put that much on because you can't put it on all at once or it all runs off, right? So it's the most expensive, but it's kind of magical because when you heat up this paint, there's a chemical reaction between the paint and the heat, and it actually foams. So it foams up and makes a jacket around the steel of insulation into Intumescent paint. You'll also see people buy it and use it to keep places where a pipe goes through a two-hour wall, like in Kent Square. If we kind of took apart that wall, we'd probably look up there and we'd be able to see that there's a special kind of sealant wherever something penetrates that two-hour wall, and that sealant is the intumescent sealant. It's the same material. When you apply heat to it, it swells up and both plugs the opening and insulates the pipe at that point. So that's the magical stuff. It's real expensive. You'll see the cost in a minute. Of course, the other way is to isolate one part of the building from the other with fire-rated floors and walls. And the last one that's most common is sprinkling. Price of sprinkling is really coming down because in a lot of applications, you don't have to use the iron pipe now. You can actually use flexible plastic pipe for the final distribution of the water. So you'll have iron pipe for the mains. So coming into this room, there may be like, you see there's, what, three sprinkler heads there. You see any more? I see three over here. Are there any in the middle? Yeah, there's three down the middle. So we may bring one black iron pipe in and have to, and that's expensive because you got to cut it on site, you got to thread it on site, and you got to have a pipe fitter put it together. So that's expensive. But then once you get to about the middle of the ceiling, you'll be able to take and make flexible PVC drops out to your sprinkler heads. Used to be you'd have to take that same pipe and go right out to the sprinkler heads. So you had no flexibility in the location of those sprinkler heads, and everything was hand fabricated, which was real expensive. So the cost of those systems are coming down now because they know, what's the worst case if I burn through one of the flexible plastic pipes? What's the worst thing that'll happen? Water is going to shoot out everywhere, yeah. I'm not going to get a great pattern out of it, but I'm still going to be putting water on the target. So, this all started, all this fire protection started after the Chicago fire. Some of the early iron buildings actually failed, and people are going, why did the iron buildings fail? They weren't supposed to burn. And of course, they didn't burn. They deflected, right? Lost their strength at about 1,000 degrees, went from being a straight line to being a curve, and slipped off their masonry supports and fell down. So they said, now when we rebuild Chicago, we got to make fireproof steel construction. And they start doing that by wrapping the steel with insulating material. So this is what they did. They took brick, terracotta, fired brick, and they put it in between the pieces of steel. And the brick is there so that the fire can't get at the steel. And of course, the bottom of the steel itself has got a little bit of plaster on it, so no steel is exposed. So this is the beginning of this idea that you cover the steel with something. The way concrete works is basically, even after it cures, it contains water, both free water that hasn't completely dried out. It's kind of like wood. When we put wood in a building, wood is maybe, at best, 18% moisture. So materials always have moisture in them. Concrete is no different. And then it's got water bound up in its chemistry. So about 20% of the concrete is water. When we heat that up, the fire's heat is used up to convert that to steam. So in concrete, when a concrete building sees fire, you might see big chunks of it pop off, spall off. kind of the way you'll see concrete spall off when there's rust behind it. But it's basically used up the fire's heat to make that happen. So it's protected the steel inside of it. Right. And then any concrete, so that process of converting water to steam in the concrete is called calcination. Same thing in sheetrock. And all we're doing is anything left after the calcination's happened gives us a physical barrier, more thickness, more protection. What's the minimum thickness of concrete over rebar? 2 inches is a good one, right? So when we walked around and we looked at, we saw some rebar that was about a half inch from the surface. What was that rebar doing? It was rusting, and what was happening to the concrete? Yeah, it was starting to pop off. You could knock on it with your finger and hear it was hollow behind there. So in concrete, the other big ingredient of fire protection is the aggregate. The denser the aggregate, which is what we use in structural concrete, the heat transfers faster, so we get a little bit less protection. Lightweight concrete actually gives us more protection because that aggregate, remember, to make lightweight concrete, say that. It's Monday. It's hard for me, too. We take aggregate and we put it in a furnace and we heat it up to the point where the water trapped inside that aggregate pops like popcorn. So lightweight aggregate basically works by displacing more volume for a given unit of weight. And because it pops, it traps air, and that makes it a little more insulating. So you'll see some buildings where up on the roof, they call for lightweight concrete fill on top of your steel deck. And it's just for fire. It just protects that, makes that steel assembly last a little bit longer in a fire. So what else could we do? So this is an airport. You might have seen this on the Discovery Channel. This is the one that's built out in a harbor off of the coast of Japan. They built their own island, and it's sinking. So underneath where the steel structure meets the piles that go down into the seabed, those anchor bolts have sensors on them, and the computer tells the crew every day, go to column B17 and put a quarter turn on that bolt. So they're constantly raising that building. They're adjusting the anchor bolts basically to raise the columns up because it's settling real time. And they figure they'll have to weld an extension on their anchor bolts in about 18 years. But the other innovative thing they did there is they fire protected their columns, but they didn't fire protect their trusses. Almost every gymnasium in America operates on this same principle. The idea is that if the steel is 20 feet or more away from the highest point of human occupancy, the temperature of the fire that you build, unless you pile up all the furniture and pour kerosene on it, the temperature of the fire won't get hot enough to compromise the steel 20 feet in the air because the air is actually going to be an insulator. So in this case, the steel up here on these big trusses, not insulated. But those columns, they got jackets on them. And those jackets are made out of GFRC, glass fiber reinforced concrete. So it's the same kind of concrete people are making lawn ornaments out of. Same kind of stuff. And glass fiber, do we use glass fiber in concrete anywhere? Where do we put fibers in concrete? Slabs. And why do we do it? Yeah, prevent cracking, make it a little stronger. This is the same stuff. So they take the concrete and they mix in the fibers because these profiles are too thin to have rebar in them. That's their problem. So they're using glass fibers to reinforce these concrete profiles. To some extent, right, right. And the volume of the space is the other thing that they're counting on. So usually this will only work in areas of so many thousand square feet. But it's still in our code, I think.
The sprinklers that spin around.
Yeah, this is the one that's got the active fire suppression system. They dare you to flick a lighter because the cannon goes and shoots you off your feet with water. They have lots of fun with fire in Japan, I guess. This is what it looks like. That's actually what those columns look like. That's the connection. So they're HSS structural members, and they've just got plates on them. The rusty looking things, that's the field connection. So one plate, their anchor bolt, their anchor plate, base plate here, see it has a plate that goes up the middle. And then these guys have a plate that comes down inside, and they put an angle between them, and lots and lots and lots of bolts. They're angled because that gives them both gravity support and lateral support at the same time. This is a Italian architect. Renzo Piano is the guy who did this. He's kind of a thoughtful fellow, very innovative with technology. So if we look up at the top, there's our unprotected steel truss, and there's our GFRC cladding on the concrete. It kind of looks like it's steel, doesn't it? It looks like a pin connection, doesn't it? And so what they did was they just designed those covers to look like what's actually happening inside. But they prettied them up a lot, wouldn't you say? I mean, compared to that, this looks a lot nicer. So it's almost like what Boyd Coddington does, you know, just before he paints it, they cover the whole car with a little bit of Bondo and then sand it down, make it look extra pretty. That's the base condition. So it is actually a pin, but when they made the cladding, they just made that cladding panel so it reflected that. Now, they had hundreds, maybe 1,000 or more of these columns. So they could afford to do this, build one form, one set of forms, and make a couple thousand of them. That pays for itself. If you got 20 columns in a building, you can't afford this most of the time. Too expensive to build those forms, because those are made up out of fiberglass. So somebody's got to make a wood mold, cover it with fiberglass, pull the fiberglass negative, and then pour the concrete inside of that. Just too much money ordinarily. So this is what we typically do. Is we take the steel and we spray on mineral fiber. And I think if we watch Bishop Favreau, we'll probably get to see this. This probably is going to be happening, though, in June, I'm going to guess. Maybe late May, actually. They did it on ChemBio. Usually they'll cover the building in plastic because they don't want this spray going everywhere. And all it does is it makes an insulating jacket around the steel. So if we need an hour, we get an inch. We need 2 hours, we get 2 inches. We need 3 hours, we get 3 inches. Some of the companies will put Portland cement in it, and that makes it a little bit more abrasion resistant, because between the electricians wanting to scrape it off to mount their boxes, so actually as a construction manager, you want the electricians to be done roughing in before you turn your fireproofing crew loose. Otherwise, you've got to have the fireproofing guys come back and do touch-up on everything that the electricians or the plumbers, anybody who's putting a hanger off of a piece of steel, they're going to knock the fire protection off. So in terms of scheduling, you want to put those two things in order. But these guys put a little Portland cement in. It makes it a little harder for us to physically sort of peel it apart. And you see we get that for about $1.32 per square foot of surface area per hour of fire protection. So if I need 2 hour fire protection, how much does that cost me a square foot? $2.64, exactly. Now even cheaper though is the stuff without the Portland cement. But you see how soft it is? That guy's not, he doesn't have hands of steel. He has, you know, kind of like office hands like mine. You know, he's just digging in there. And maybe he's on the phone, you know. When people talk on the phone, they're just like, yeah, you know. And you'll find that around where the crews have lunch, there'll be a lot of damage to the fire protection. You'll find that around the elevator, the job elevator, the lift, because people standing around, we're nervous. We're just nervous all the time. And we pick at stuff. And so this stuff, the regular sprayed on, doesn't give you that extra density, so it doesn't give you that human factor protection. But it's cheap, $90 a square foot per hour. So if I need a 3 hour, how much does it cost me a square foot? How much? What am I bid? $2.70 is the winner. Oop. I'm going to fall before the end of the year. Gypsum board, of course, is pretty low tech. We all know how to work with that. In this case, in order to get the covering on the gypsum board, I've got to put up some steel studs. So I've got some tracks that attach to the flanges. Usually I'm going to put a bottom track in into the floor and a top track in on the underside of the deck, and my steel studs are just going to span between those. and be screwed to the top and bottom tracks. But it operates like concrete. It calcinates. About one-fifth of its weight is water. And usually to get any kind of fire protection out of it, it's going to be 5/8 inch. You see, it gets built up in layers. So there's a layer against the steel. There's two steel studs. So they're actually they're not anchored to the steel because it's really hard to put any kind of screw into the surface of a quarter, 3/8, 1/2 inch, 1 inch thick steel flange. So usually you don't bother. You connect it down at the floor and up at the ceiling. You put a track at the bottom and the top, and that steel stud spans between them, just like a regular partition steel stud would do. And all it's there for is to give us a surface to attach with drywall screws to attach the drywall to the steel stud. That's all it's there for. What are these things called? Corner bead. Yeah. They're just armor, basically, for the corner. They help hold the corner together. And you see how this one right there, you see the line right there? So this one runs past. And on this layer, this one runs past this way. The code is always going to ask you to overlap those joints because they know that when that column starts to heat up, it's going to twist. And as it twists, it's going to want to open up those sheetrock joints. So they're going to want the drywall corners on there, and they're going to want you to overlap the joints. So this one runs through this way, so that means the layer outside of that runs through the other way so that you don't get an open channel to the fire. And that's all the inspector is going to be looking for. They'll look at the label on the sheetrock to see that it says 5/8 fire code or 5/8 type X, depending on who you buy it from. Otherwise, it's pretty straightforward, and there are many, many UL designs depending on the size of the steel that you got and the condition that you got, whether it's a column or a beam or a girder. So between the U.S. Gypsum catalog, which is online, and U.S. Gypsum will give away the UL designs to you, but only the ones that use their product, right? Because they don't want you taking and using their competitor's product after they paid for everything. UL will sell you the designs, but the manufacturers will give them away. So if you need to find a design for a rated steel beam, column, joist, you go to the manufacturers of the fire protection, their websites, and they'll have designs on them. So spray-on fire protection, you're looking for the company like Monocoat. Sheetrock, you're looking for U.S. Gypsum or Gold Bond Gypsum, one of those guys. And they'll give you the designs. And they've got them for walls as well. And they'll also test the sound transmission of the walls. So if the code says, or your client says, or the local zoning says that the walls between one apartment and the other have to have a sound transmission coefficient rating of this, USG can tell you how to build that. And they'll give you that design for free because they want you to buy their product. It's a good relationship, I think. We already talked about the mass of the column. When you get to the ceiling, it gets a little trickier. You can buy, and this one isn't a lay-in board ceiling. In Kent Square, we've got a lay-in board ceiling, but it's not really fire-rated. That means that the tiles are made out of a wood fiber. The ones in a fire-rated ceiling are made out of mineral fiber. The ones in Kent Square are loose. You can just push them up. In a fire-rated ceiling, you have to put hold-down clips on them so that the fire can't push them up. Any time you poke a hole in the ceiling, like here there's a light fixture, you've got to protect it. So here they've got some fireproof insulation going over the top of the light fixtures. I think there's nothing harder to build than a fire-rated lay-in board ceiling. It's a lot of tedious detail work. A lot of tedious detail work. Every time a duct dumps air through it, there's got to be a fire damper on that duct. And, of course, you'd like the fire dampers to be the kind that automatically reset. I think the first project that I had, remodeling of a bank, they said, well, mostly the biggest problem is our mechanical system is just horrible. It's just horrible. No, everyone's too hot. It's always stuffy. People are always falling asleep in meetings. And this is the president talking. He's going like, it's not like I'm a boring speaker. And we popped up in the ceiling and looked at it, and they had manual fire dampers. Fire dampers that would trip and fall, so gravity makes them fall and close off the duct opening to make a continuous fire-protected plane at the ceiling like you're supposed to. But then when the fire alarm is reset, they don't pull up. 80% of the guy's dampers were down. That's why the mechanical system wasn't working for like 30 years. We told him that, and we said, you really don't have to replace all this, you know. A lot of this hasn't been used for 30 years. So then he gave us the contract to reclad the building, which was even better score. This is the magic stuff, intumescent paint. So you see it doesn't make as thick a coating around the steel as the mineral fiber does. But it doesn't exactly conform to the steel either. It takes a very skilled applicator to make it look good. Usually, I mean, if I put it on, it would look like somebody troweling on asphalt. It would look pretty nasty. But a skilled applicator can do a pretty good job. The big problem with it was for a long time only available. It was like Henry Ford's idea about choice. You know, you could get a Model T in any color you wanted as long as it was black or black. Black was all they offered. So these guys, AD Firefilm, figured out how to make an intumescent paint that you could actually have color with. And now it's starting to take off again. Because for a long time, nobody would use it because you couldn't paint it. But look at the cost. $15 a square foot an hour. So if I got to do a three-hour assembly out of this, what am I looking at? I'm almost $50 a square foot. On the paint. Yow! That's a house, right? $50 a square foot. So this is, you know, you'll see, you might run into designers who will say, because they'll look at it, and they might look at it as, well, this is the answer to everything. I can have all the steel exposed and have a three-hour frame. And you would just go, yes, but that means the steel, the fire protection will probably cost more than the steel. And they get to make the choice. At that point, the owner and the architect could say, well, it's really important, so we're going to do it. And then you just say, okay, and you write the subcontract, and the subcontractor puts it on, and you're all good to go, everybody's happy. But you let them know how much more than the sprayed-on mineral fiber is that? 15 times more. So, it's magic, but you pay real money for magic. Who's the guy in Las Vegas that makes elephants disappear? Those aren't cheap tickets. It's hard to make those elephants disappear, right? David Copperfield or whatever his name is. All right, so once we've protected the building, then all we have to do is get people out. You remember the egress, endangered species? Egress is the life safety system of the building. So a building has a structural system, a mechanical system, an electrical system, a plumbing system, and it's got a life safety system. And the egress is what the building code calls that system. So it's a way out. So it's the corridors, stair enclosures, stairs, that all the places that people have to go through in a fire to get out of the building, that's the egress system. And the code will want all that protected. New to the egress system that some people you work with may not recognize is this thing called area of refuge. Now that we've made buildings accessible to everyone, we realize that if my mom's on the 10th floor at her doctor's office and there's a fire in her wheelchair, she is not going to get out. She's just not. So now we recognize that we have to make safe places in the building now. So these areas of refuge are basically that. They're safe places in the building. Most of the time they're inside the stair enclosure, and they've got a communications panel so that when the fire chief rolls up and plugs into the main fire protection panel, usually that's in a lobby or something, they can tell by the board, looking at the board, what sprinklers are going off, what zones are active, and where are people calling for help. So the area of refuge is one of those places that a person who can't get up and down the stairs, either because they got heart problems or they're not fully ambulatory, they can get to an area of refuge and hit the button and talk to the person who's manning that, the fire chief's main board, and say, send somebody up to carry me down. And the firefighters go over and do that. Chicago, I'm going to say it's less than 5 years ago, county building, main county office building, downtown Chicago, has a fire. And it's built before this. Built to withstand collapse, but the smoke, of course, is what kills everybody, right? So people get into the stairwell, and some of the stairway doors had been wedged open. You see people do this, right? When they have to carry stuff in and out of a fire stair, they put a doorstop down to keep the doors open. So some of the stair towers were just filled with smoke and were impassable. People are using their cell phones and calling 911 and saying, I'm in the stairwell. Well, the building had 8 stairwells, and no one knew where they were. Because when you're down on the ground, you can't see it says floor 7 because there's too much smoke. So they lost, a little over a dozen people in that fire. Frustrated the firefighters to no end because they're getting the calls and no one can tell where they are. So these areas of refuge are part of the help for that. Because all you do is you hit that big button and it tells the firefighters exactly where you are. So the corridor, of course, is, that's self-explanatory. Most apartment buildings have those things in the middle. And that's a fire-rated tube, basically. Any doors that go into that have to be fire-rated, have to be self-closing. Ceiling is fire-rated. That's your safe place to get out. It will fill with smoke. It probably will. We're supposed to have emergency lighting in those things. I would say now the Pentagon has gone even farther, and they put the emergency lighting and the exit signs, like those red exit signs, see that they're above there? I told you this already, didn't I? The fire that I was in one of my buildings. Yeah. So the smoke was so thick, we could not see the exit sign in an 8-foot-high ceiling corridor. It was that thick. I mean, you put out your hand and you don't have any fingers. So I think in the Pentagon now, they're putting lights down at about 3 feet. And they're putting electroluminescent panels that tell you where you are down at the floor, because where do people go when it fills up with smoke? You go down, right? So they've started to do that because they recognize that the code is written for the best case scenario and doesn't work as well in the worst case scenario. Code still requires the exit signs up high. People are starting to add them down low so that when you're crawling, you can find your way out. And the exit is, that's the other part of the building separated that gets you to outside. And usually it's to a public way. So all of you are occupants. And how would we determine the occupant load of this room? The great quiz question. Maybe a great final exam question. There's a sign in the back of the room that says maximum occupancy, but how would the code determine it in here? Count the seats, because these are bolted down, right? Count the seats. Now, if this is to Kent Square, where we do our class, the seats aren't bolted down, right? So there they say, we're going to say you take up so many square feet. We're going to take and divide that room by that many square feet. That's how many people we're going to plan for in that room or allow in that room.
So here we see an occupant load table, very similar to the one that you'll find in the International Building Code. And we're working with an example building of a 400 or a 40,000 square foot business occupancy. So here the building code asks us to classify the occupancy type in this chart. So we'd say our Kent Square facility is a business area. So it would say every person takes up about 100 gross square feet. And gross square feet includes the hallways and the bathrooms and the stairwells and the elevator and all the service, storage, and custodial areas. So we take the overall area of the building, divide it by 100, and that's how many people we have in it. So here, if we have a 40,000 square foot office building, divided by 100, we'll have 400 occupants in the building as far as the code is concerned. So with that calculated number of occupants, 400, and we're working with an example of a four-story building here, the code says we have to plan the size of the egress or the life safety system to handle those 400 people. Because our example has is a four-story building, in theory, you could say we have to account for all 400 people at the bottom floor, but the building code understands that all those people from the upper floors won't get to the bottom floor all at the same time, and the people in the lower floor will probably be out. So the code says that when exits converge at a floor level, like the ground floor where they're going to leave the building, the occupant load for that floor must take into account the occupant load of the floor immediately above. So in this case, we'd have the 100 people from the first floor, and we'd add in the 100 people from the second floor. So our egress components would have to be sized to handle 200 occupants. So now if we want to figure out what that exactly means, it means that we take the total number of occupants that are being served by that floor and multiply that by 0.3 to determine the width of a stair run in an unsprinkled building, and 0.2 for corridors and other egress components like doors in unsprinkled buildings. If the building's sprinkled, we can use smaller multipliers, so we can use 0.2 for stairs and 0.15 for other components. So our top floor stair in the unsprinkled building, in theory, according to the code here, could be would have to be no less than 100 times 0.3, or 30 inches wide. Now that would comply with this section of the code, but certainly wouldn't comply with the other minimum requirements of the IBC for a minimum width of a stair, or the Americans with Disability Act for that matter. So the building code has written in, it understands that different parts of the code are written by different groups at different times, so it has sort of an overall rule that says make it 0.3 for stairs and unsprinkled buildings, but not less than specified elsewhere in this code. So in that case, if the number of occupants multiplied by the egress factor at 0.3 for unsprinkled building stairways actually turned out to be larger than the Americans with Disabilities Act required, we would put in that larger number. If, like in this example, the total width of the stair only turns out to be 30 inches, not wide enough to meet the minimums stated in other places of the International Building Code or the Americans with Disabilities Act, the larger dimension governs. And you don't take, even though there are two stairs exiting that top floor, we don't take and divide the number of occupants by two. The theory is that each floor should be able to handle, the egress components on each floor should be able to handle the total load of that floor at all times. So even though we have a left and right stair, both stairs have to be sized for 100 occupants. We can't divide that load into two groups of occupants of 50.